There's some reefs around here that nobody's ever charted.
I think it's much worse than reefs, Matt. There's something horrible in that fog.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books, and especially Forgotten Horrors Volume 5, The Atom Age, by John Woolley, Jan Allen Henderson, and yours truly. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you, the unmistakable voice of Michael H. Price, who is the brains behind Cremo Studios, perpetrating existentialism in any number of comic book-like ways, as well as the Forgotten Horrors books, which I've been proud and honored to be a little part of as you've gone through those, Michael. So welcome to the show, folks. We're talking about, Michael and I are both old disc jockeys, and so this is a request. We're doing a request night tonight. We heard from, I was doing the comic book convention, the Oklahoma Alliance of Fans, or OAF, in Oklahoma, obviously. I helped found back in the 60s, and we have started a few years ago to have yearly conventions. Well, at one of these conventions, a fellow I know named Ellis Goodson. Now, Ellis is he's a storyboard artist, a layout artist. He does video games. He worked on the Curious George movie. He worked on other movies. And of course, he does comic books as well. And Ellis said, "Have you ever done anything on Voice in the Night?" Well, that was a new one on me. Were you aware of this before we started talking about it, Michael?
Aware of the story and aware of its existence as part of a television series called Suspicion.
Right. That's right.
But no great immediate acquaintance with it. I mean, I'm sure I had seen it when I was a kid on TV. That ran in 1957.
1957?
Actually, 58, the second year of Suspicion.
That's right, March of 58, yeah.
And I'm sure I must have, I had already become a big fan of William Hope Hodgson, the author. And knew the story, knew its connection to a somewhat later film called Matango.
Also known as Attack of the Mushroom People.
Attack of the Mushroom People, which I'm sure Hodgson would not have had much use for. But on backtracking, and we received this very thoughtful and provocative request to discuss this thing, went backtracking, and difficult to find in a really good video edition. I think we finally had to resort to a YouTube transfer.
And it's very, very dark, and I think that's the only way. And Joey, who can find anything, that's the only thing he could find, too. So I don't
There's
know.
A boxed set of Suspicion, but I do not believe Voice in the Night is on that
Oh,
box.
Really? Really? Do you know who put it out or anything?
No, I'd have to look that up, but that's not difficult to do with our cheat sheets in front of us.
Right, that's right. Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about the source material. William Hope Hodgson, of course, the name of the story initially was The Nightland. And, you know, I'm a big pulp guy, and this is from a very early pulp, the Blue Book magazine, back in 1907. William Hope Hodgson, who, as you have said earlier when we were talking about this off the air before preparing for the show, preparing for the podcast, was a big influence on H.P. Lovecraft.
Right.
Yeah. And so this is 1907, and this is essentially, well, it really is kind of about a couple of mushroom people, I guess.
So you really can't fault the you really can't fault the movie people for using the term mushroom people.
No, you can't. This has a great cast, really. Although you never the print that we have seen. That it's a very dark print, and you can't really see James Coburn, who is, I think, the first mate on board the ship, where Barbara Rush and James Donald, James Donald comes to the ship and tells the backstory of he's looking for supplies, and Patrick McNee is the captain of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically a four-character show. And Barbara Rush and James Donald, well, we don't want to give too much away. But
no, can't afford to do that. But no, yeah, go ahead and walk around it.
Well, let's walk around a little bit. There's a ghostly voice that comes out of seemingly nowhere that the captain of this ship hears, and someone is wanting to get some provisions for himself and his wife. Mm-hmm. And that's how the backstory unfolds. Now, if you want to draw that line from this story to Attack of the Mushroom People, obviously there is fungus involved here. And in Attack of the Mushroom People, the Japanese film, as you say, Matango was the original name, and it was Americanized to Attack of the Mushroom People for the 63 release.
Sure.
The people who, the husband and wife, who are basically marooned on an island, and there is fungus involved, and it's one of those things where it's kind of taking them over, I guess, like I say, without giving too much away. It's a lot like and I don't know if it's because it's so dark, the print that we have seen, the only print extant that we know of is so dark, but it's much like a radio play, isn't it?
Very, very much theater of the mind, and of course that's, I'm sure that would be less of the mind and more of the eyes if we could obtain a nice crisp print. And what's amazing about poor preservation is that this was an Alfred Hitchcock production.
That's what I wanted to ask you. It said Alfred Hitchcock's voice in the night. Michael, what does that mean?
That means he was the executive producer of Suspicion.
Oh, of the whole, of the overall
of
series.
Of the series. And, and what's most interesting, when I found a copy of the Hodgson story, it appeared in an Alfred Hitchcock anthology.
No, really?
Yeah, it has appeared elsewhere, of course, and the great steering point toward Hodgson, of course, was Lovecraft's essay from 1928, Supernatural Horror and Literature,
which you have made into a comic book. I hasten to add, a comic book story.
Exactly.
And I'm not sure where does that run. Where did that appear, or where does that appear?
You mean the comic book story?
Yeah, the comic book story that you did.
I think that appeared in one of the early comics from the Gone World.
I think
books.
You're right. I think.
But then,
right.
You know, I guess I'm too busy making this stuff to keep track of where it lands.
No.
But what was interesting is that the Hodgson story, when I first discovered it, showed up in this anthology edited by Alfred Hitchcock called "Stories They Wouldn't Let Me Put on TV."
Nice.
And of course, the book came out before Suspicion was in production.
So it was a 50s. It was a 50s book.
Right. So eventually he managed to sneak it on the TV.
Really?
The Suspicion series is generally quite as good as the better-known Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
Which post-dated it, I'm assuming.
They were pretty close together in time.
Okay. Okay.
Both ran on NBC during that period of the post-war 50s and 60s.
So were they ever running simultaneously that you know?
I'm sure they crossed over at some point. I'd have to go back and check a log dates, but the Suspicion stories ran weekly for what, two seasons, 57-59, on the NBC network.
Mm-hmm. And this was Sterling Siliphant who adapted the story from the pulps, and of course Sterling Siliphant, big TV writer, almost up there with Reginald Rose and Patty Chayefsky and those guys, known, I guess, mainly for Route 66?
Oh, yeah, definitely for Route 66. And, of course, the director is Arthur Hiller.
Yes, yes.
Who directed a whole lot of Route 66.
Yes, he did.
And Naked City and Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And very prolific director. He was a contemporary of Sam Peckinpah. And he and Peckinpah worked together on The Rifles and Riflemen.
Right. Well, there's so much misdirection in this story because, of course, they couldn't show a lot of things. There's so much hinted at. There's so much misdirection with voices and all of that. It's the kind of horror I like, Michael. Now, look, I wrote for Fangoria for many years. I wrote well over 100 stories for Fangoria, and they sent me places, and I love Tony Timpone and the guys over there. But really, when it gets down to it, this is that kind of story that you remember from when you were a kid at Halloween. And you heard the stories that were not explicit, but hinted at the horror that was involved. This is one of those stories.
Which is what makes the picture so perfectly appropriate for a Japanese film of this nature, because the Japanese, as a rule, I mean, the prevailing Japanese horror film style is subtlety.
Yes. And this is a very subtle film.
Yeah, and this is one that I'm surprised it didn't get revived in Japan or Korea when they were doing all those The Ring.
Yes, right.
The series pictures.
Right. Yeah, it's ripe for being reappraised, but you know, it could very easily become a special effects sort of extravaganza, which would I think take away a lot from this story.
Now, really, all you need is some good ground fog and subtle lighting and a sense of brooding unease.
Yeah, and people wondering what the hell's happening to him. You know, there's one line in there where Barbara Rush, who's the wife, says to her husband, James Donald, she says, "I keep thinking God has put us in this place for some good reason."
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was one of the creepiest lines of the whole deal. Because there doesn't seem to be any good reason at all. I mean, you can argue that there's something in there about the transcendent power of love and all of this, but really it's just they're there because the fungus is going to eat them up, and that's pretty much it. The end, you know? I don't think there's any greater cosmic significance for what happens to them except kind of the luck of the draw.
Well, that's why Hodgson was so influential upon the the latter half of the first generation of pulp writers.
Yes.
And then the second generation, basically the roman noir or dark novel,
yes,
emerged from the pulps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's what's the constant in film noir and the dark novels? Random misfortune.
Fate. Fate does
yes,
it for you.
Fate. Besides fedoras, you know.
And low-key lighting.
Yeah.
You know, all you have to do is take a look at Detour, and that is the archetypal film noir.
Oh yeah, and Fate. As Tom Neal says in Detour, fate puts the finger on you.
That's right, and you've done nothing to deserve it, necessarily. All that poor guy's trying to do is get back to see his girlfriend in Hollywood, and there you go. And in this case, there's no good reason, there's no compelling reason that this married couple encounters this fungus. I mean, they do get on a ghost ship, and they do get some food, but none of it is nefarious in any way, right?
And yes, exactly.
They're just fate just puts the finger on them, as you said, and as Tom Neal said in Detour.
Mm-hmm.
There's some good acting in this. It's essentially really a two-character play, isn't it?
Well, yeah, not to mention that the faces are right.
Yes.
The posture. Coburn discovered very early that he was indeed James Coburn.
Right.
No star pretensions, but certainly an assertive presence that
right.
you see come to the fore later on in the 60s as the whole world realized who James Coburn
right.
was.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, and he had the perfect face for a hapless adventurer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Patrick McNee does, you know, he does a very workmanlike job here. I think Barbara Rush is terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And James Donald as well. Do you know much about James Donald?
I only have his filmography. I've really never followed his work.
I never have either. I think he's British, isn't he?
Scots.
Scotch. Okay. All right.
And long career, of course. I mean, mm-hmm. he was in film right up through. Well, speaking of film noir, his last picture was the 1978 remake of The Big Sleep.
Right, with Mitchum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
And he was the doctor in Quatermass in the Pit.
Of course, that's right. That's right. And of course, Barbara Rush had her share of genre films, certainly most notably with the Ray Bradbury picture. It came from outer space.
It came from outer space.
And
yes,
she does a wonderful job, and she does a wonderful job in that one and in this one. And it's the kind of thing, and gore is fine. I don't have any trouble with gore at all. Lord knows, but there's something to be said for the creepiness that you get in this little picture or this little TV episode.
It's an amazing piece of terror by suggestion.
That's a good way to put it. Terror by suggestion. Now, did Suspicion do a lot of this sort of thing where they ventured off into the macabre, or was it more cops and robbers, detectives?
They were a lot more like thriller in the sense that they waffled.
Yes.
Suspicion waffled between crime melodrama and specialized in the surprise ending.
I see.
And occasionally got into some really creepy business, but my gosh, what an all-star cast they had over the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Betty Davis, mm-hmm. William Shatner at the beginning of his career, and of course he became a mainstay on Thriller.
Right.
Agnes Moorehead, Donna Reed, Rory Calhoun, Audie Murphy, they were all on Suspicion one time or another.
Well, of course, Barbara Rush had been a contract player at a major studio too.
Right.
Got a lot of that kind of stuff. So, unfortunately, I mean, the downside is that if you decide to watch this on TV or on the internet, the upside is that it's free. The downside is it's a pretty terrible print. especially early on.
My suggestion would be to obtain the 3 DVD set. It's called Suspicion Volume 1.
Uh-huh.
And get a handle on the series before you go back and try to watch this boogery print on YouTube.
I see. Okay, but you don't think that this is on that collection then?
I am looking at the playlist right now, mm-hmm. and the titles are indeed tantalizing. Uh-huh. Heartbeat, uh-huh. Doomsday, uh-huh. The Other Side of the Curtain, Touch of Evil, not to be confused with the Orson Welles picture,
sure. Yeah.
Meeting in Paris, The Eye of Truth, The Bull Skinner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But no, this our little selection here is not on that playlist.
Well, we're hoping maybe somebody will come along, and if another print is struck or somebody comes up with a better print, we'll be sure to let folks know about that, and we'll want to watch it again. I want to watch it again with a nice print, too.
Now, I'd like to watch it in a nice 16-millimeter print on about a 20-by-40 screen.
On October 31st in a barn somewhere, sitting on some hay bales, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Well, we would recommend it, definitely. It's one of those chilling shows that is absent completely of gore, but the misdirection and the suggestion is very creepy and really makes it worthwhile. As Boris Karloff, I think, said, anyone can show you a bucket of entrails.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Boris Karloff being quoted as saying that, but it takes a little bit more skill to really create terror. And I think this one does. This has got some really creepy moments in it.
That's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work.
It is. Now, I want to say this is the time when we're going to be plugging our stuff. And I want to say you have been nominated for an award, the Ghosts and Girls of Fiction House.
Oh, yeah.
I really enjoyed a great deal. Tell us about the award you were nominated for.
Nice break. It's called the Ghastly Awards.
The Ghastly Awards.
They're on the web at, I think it's Ghastly Awards. Hang on, I can almost tell you off the top of my head. But better to be accurate.
Well, while you're being accurate, we want to let people know they're not named after the EC artist Gasly Graham Ingalls, as far as we know, or are they?
Actually, it is named in honor of Gasly Graham Ingalls.
All right, good.
And the program is, although the logo looks more like an Edward Gorey drawing. So, anyway, now the Gasly Awards, I think this is their fifth year, and they recognize horror comics,
mm-hmm.
which definitely our book, The Ghosts and Girls of Fiction House, is. They're at ghastlyawards.com, and anybody can vote.
Okay, good.
And so, you
so
know,
vote early and often, as they used to say. And I have to also add, with the Ghosts and Girls of Fiction House, you also kind of split off from that with your own Cremo Studios version of some of those stories, or some of the Ghost Gallery stories. We might say that these are the Drew Murdoch stories. These collect the Drew Murdoch stories from Fiction House, right?
Definitely. Ran in the 40s in a magazine called Jumbo Comics.
Jumbo Comics, right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And there's some wonderful stuff, some wonderful artists working on that. But if you go, I suggest getting both, which I have both of those. I have the Ghost.
Oh, you mean the Gripes of Wraith.
And then I have the Gripes of Wraith, which, and both of them take the stories, but they take them in a little bit different directions.
Right, yeah. The book called Ghosts and Girls is just straightforward restorations.
Yes.
As close to an authentic printing as you can get without paying $300 for a worm-eaten pulp magazine.
Right.
Good restoration by Clesia Gassoni at Yo Books. And we have compatible but different styles of restoration. I tend to go for more gingerbread, goosing up the color, correcting
mm-hmm.
flaws from the original printings,
mm-hmm.
things like that. And there's room for all different approaches. But where we really part ways is that I've got this bad habit of rewriting some of the trite and fatuous dialogue of the original comic books.
Well, you know, I wouldn't call it a bad habit, Michael. I'd call it a compulsion.
It's a
full-blown compulsion. But I love it. It just amuses the hell out of me. And if anybody wants to go on Amazon, for instance, and take a look at The Gripes of Wraith, I believe that's the one that I wrote. I was moved to write an online review. Yes,
that's the one. Yes,
and because I was just so taken, so smitten by how crazy it was, and
mm-hmm.
As I think I called it, what existential vaudeville.
Oh yeah,
and I'll stand by that description. It's terrific, and I really would recommend it. And I want to say also that I still available. And, you know, we're still selling. It's very odd, but we are still selling copies of Hardboiled Christmas Stories at this 3 months out, or however long it is. We're still getting some Hardboiled Christmas Stories, so take a look at that as well, if you would. And also,
Hardboiled Christmas Stories, you know, it ain't just for Christmas anymore.
No, it's not just for Christmas anymore, and neither is Homicide Highball,
yeah.
which reprints my original script, never before seen, for Dan Turner Hollywood Detective, celebrating its 25th year this year. 25 years ago, we made that made-for-TV movie, and
wow.
it was supposed to be set in the contemporary times and supposed to star Ray Parker Jr. So I
mm-hmm.
wrote this whole thing, and then by the time I got into the script, they said, no, we want it 40s. And so the 80s script has never been seen. It's got a heavy metal cab driver in it.
Oh,
it's got,
yeah.
Got a lot of different things. And so that is available from Rich Harvey's Bold Venture Press down in Florida. And it's been selling more briskly than it has a right to.
That's great.
So we're hanging in there, and we're planning a real surprise, I think, with the next Forgotten Horrors, aren't we?
Oh, I'll say.
Guess so. And we do want to thank Ellis Goods. And Ellis, thank you so much. I hope that you're listening to the podcast, because we really appreciate the suggestion to do Voice in the Night, which we've just done. If anybody has a suggestion, Michael, I mean, we're wide open. Obviously, if you follow what we've been doing, we're wide open to talk about anything.
Well, yeah, and jump on the page, jump on the Forgotten Horrors podcast page on Facebook and make your suggestions.
And we'll be happy to hear anything. Michael, it's always great to visit. Let's do it again soon.
Delighted.
All right.
Mm-hmm.